First, I just want to say a huge thank you for having me here today, and thank you to Pastor Paul, and also lovely to see you again, Ruth. Ruth and I worked together for a number of years when she worked at Tūtama Wahine. And Sam Brown's Nana, it's always lovely to see you again too. I thought before I get into my story, it's always good to know who's standing in front of you and just to know a little bit about them. So I'll just introduce you to some of my family. So, you know, I'm not a stranger. So, turn the clicker on. So this is my mum and dad. They're actually sitting in the back row. They weren't here at the 8 o'clock service. So my mum and dad, Pauline and Clive. So dad's an engineer and mum's an administration assistant for an engineering firm as well. Dad's actually in the middle of the Methanex shutdown, so if he nods off, that's because he's been working like 70-hour weeks. So this is my family. In the back, in the middle, is my brother Dan and his wife Monique. In the front, my brother-in-law Sam and his wife Sarah, and then to the right is Christy, and Christy's in the back row today too. And Sarah and Christy are twins, and then also here today is my flatmate Greer. I thought I'd introduce you to the best flatmate that we have. This is Max. He thinks he's human, and he's our fifth flatmate. And this is my little sister, Neosha. Some of you might have heard of Big Brother, Big Sister, which is a mentoring program that's run through the police. So Neosha and I have been matched since she was 5 years old, so she's five in the left-hand picture. She's nearly 10 now, and yeah, so we're going out for lunch after this today, so we've been... I hang out with her anywhere from kind of an hour to 3 hours a week. So, I just thought I'd give you a bit of a background of my story and then move into what we do in terms of the Emergency Housing Trust, how God's kind of led me on this amazing journey over the past few years, and then how Operation Blue Santa all kind of rolled out of that as well. So growing up, we always had an open home. We were never rich. I remember one of my school photos, I've got both my front teeth have fallen out, and I was wearing a highlighter yellow pants and a highlighter yellow top, so there's like twin tracksuits. That photo never comes out, by the way. but Mum would always cook for more than six people. We always had an open door policy and anyone was welcome for dinner. Dozens of our friends would identify with our family as their own. Everyone was welcome and everyone was accepted. For as long as I can remember, I've always had a burden for the lost and the broken and the hurting in our city. When I was 18, I remember receiving a prophecy from a minister at a camp, Easter camp I attended, and God started to really speak to me about serving our community. I remember crying my eyes out at that camp as God moved in my life. Part of my role at Tūtama Wahine is as a children's family violence program facilitator. While the parents receive counselling around and education around family violence, I work with the kids to understand that they ensure how they know to stay safe, that they have a safety plan, they know how to phone 111, and know how to clearly identify safe people in their world. My work at Tūtama Wahine became more varied, and I saw the needs of children in our community and the poverty they were subject to by no fault of their own. Where possible, I would try and meet their needs in a simple way. If they needed clothing, I would look for people who I knew who had clothing at the age of those children. If they needed a bed, I would try and get them a bed. 95% of the needs that we met for these children were met by people in church. My heart to see the church meet the needs of our community in a practical way was starting to unravel, and I knew there were exciting times ahead. At the same time, we had a number of crises within the community, with families coming into the office at Tūtama Wahine who were homeless, and they would take up residence for six weeks in a local emergency house. My heart broke for them every single time we had to put them in there. The house was often filthy, unkept, and smelly. My heart started to stir about the possibilities for a clean, tidy, welcoming house that could have a family live in it for a certain amount of time, with direct access to the services that Tūtama Wahine provides for the community around budgeting, counselling, schooling, food, clothing, and then a plan around wealth creation that would see them enrolling in further education and in charge of their own future. Every time I entertained the thought of having a house available for a family, I got more excited and passionate about it, and while attending a women's conference, which Pastor Pip runs, I was challenged about firing arrows of hope and peace and opportunity into our community. So following the conference, I really started to give this emergency housing idea some thought, and I'd pray about it constantly. I bought a sketchbook, Now, just FYI, I'm no sketcher. My sister Christy is a qualified 2D and 3D animator, so she can make things like Shrek and Avatar move. Me, I'm lucky if I get a stick figure right. So I bought a sketchbook and some felt and started to write, draw and dream, and God really, really started to stir something in me. Each time I prayed about the projects and friends of mine, Paul and Joy Russell would pop into my head. I didn't know why, I didn't know how, but I just had this peace that at some point in the journey they would become involved. How this looked, I had no idea, so I let the idea sit until the right time came about to discuss it. Then in October 2015, I was minding my own business at church, sitting at the sound desk, waiting for the morning service to start. My phone beeped, and it was Paul Russell. Completely out of the blue. Paul has never contacted me before. It was always Joy who I communicated with. He stated in his message that he and Joy had been talking about me recently, and that they had a couple of ideas they wanted to run past me. Instantly, I knew this was the time. A week later, I went out to Paul and Joy's house. They were really excited about some opportunities they wanted to create for a holiday program and birthday cakes for kids who would ordinarily go without. I was blown away. I then said to them that I had this idea on my heart for a very long time, but I knew I had to wait until the timing was right to talk to them about it. I told them that in my own head it just seemed out of reach, so out there that if they didn't want to or they couldn't be part of it, it was absolutely okay. I gave them every reason to back out before I'd even told them my idea. But I wanted to open an emergency house for women and children in our community, and I wondered if they wanted to be part of it. Well, Joy looked like a possum in headlights, and Paul started to weep. Now, I'm not sure if Joy was more shocked at the idea or the fact that her husband was crying. It took a while for words to come out and the shock to settle, but when they finally spoke, they stated that this was something that they had had on their hearts for a very long time. They stated they'd been discussing over the past 2 weeks how they could make their dream of being able to assist women and children be a reality also. The atmosphere in the room was electric. It was like a door that had been shut for all of us, we were now standing in front of, wide open. I discussed with Paul and Joy that my biggest concern and barrier was how we would get a house. I stated that in my head we would need 7 investors, and how would we keep people on the same page with the right heart and the right mindset for the project. Paul then abolished every single barrier by stating that he and Joy would purchase a house. Now, at this point, I was the possum in headlights. So in March 2016, Paul and Joy purchased a house specifically for the project. God's provision was again all over this, as they were able to purchase a property which was a 4-bedroom house, a 2-bedroom flat, and with an empty section, all below GV. The house was a mess, to the point where the kitchen floor had rotted right through to under the house. So Paul and Joy, with Paul's parents, spent the next 6 months renovating the property. So I'll just show you some before and after shots of the house so you can kind of get a picture of how bad it was. So this is the house at Bell Block. So this is the 4-bedroom property. And if you just look to the very left of the picture, you'll see a ranch slider. That's the 2-bedroom flat. So this is what it looked like when we took it over. You'll see the checkered lino, and then there's the big piece of wood there. That's where the floor rotted and fell through under the house. So the previous owners couldn't be bothered fixing it. So they just got a big plank of wood and found the least rotten beam and nailed it to it. So they had to balance on this piece of wood even just to wash their dishes. So Paul and Joy and Paul's parents spent a considerable amount of time fixing this up. So this is what it looks like today. I remember the day we went in and had a look at the open home, and we all came out with numerous flea bites all over us. The house was just riddled with fleas, so that all the carpet was pulled up and replaced. And so that's what the lounge looks like today. So all with a new slap of paint and some new carpet. So the three of us decided to hire the superior expertise of our old senior pastor, Ken Price, to discuss the legalities of how to start a trust. So we booked in the big boss and flew up to Auckland and spent 5 hours with him in the McDonald's cafe party room at Auckland Airport. We talked through everything from the name to the company's office and how to write a trust deed. For time's sake, and to keep a really long story short, In April 2016, Roderick Hope Trust was born. I spent 4 months researching and writing a trust deed and applied to the Charities Commission for charity status, which was approved in 6 weeks instead of 6 months, which we, as was how long it had been taken, would have taken. God continued to open doors for us. Around the same time, the media had started to pay attention to homelessness in New Zealand on a national scale, and the government had given social service organisations the opportunity to apply for a contract to support families in need of housing so that they only had to pay income-based rent, which is 25% of their income. I remember reading over the contract and thinking there's no way we would ever be successful in an application like this. We needed Ministry of Social Development Level 2 approval status, which is very difficult to get approved and very difficult to maintain. I left it for about 2 weeks, till right before the close-off date, when I really felt pressed to talk to management at Tutumuahine about it. So I went into my manager's office and talked it through with her, and she was completely on board. Next thing I knew, Tutumuahine and Roderick Hope Trust were doing a joint application to the Ministry of Social Development for the National Emergency Housing Contract. It's always a harrowing wait when you do an application like that, but as a team we prayed and said, God, if this is what you want us to do, just open the door, and if it's not, close it and close it tight. Before we knew, we were successful in the application. Another open door. On the 5th of September 2016, we had an incredible launch for the Trust. We had a number of key speakers and businesses and community organisations from around Taranaki gather with us to support and celebrate the initiative being available for our most vulnerable families in the community. Actually, I think you were there, weren't you, Ruth? That's right. There was large media attention around the opening of our 4-bedroom house in Bell Block. So much community support, we were absolutely over the moon. In late September, I received a phone call from a property owner stating he had just bought a house off his father who had gone into a rest home and would like us to come and view his property in consideration for it being used for emergency housing purposes. Marie, our property manager, and I were keen to have a look. So we went and looked at the house and decided that it would probably be a great opportunity. We took the idea to the team, and everybody was happy that we should further apply to the Ministry of Social Development to see if we could extend our contract. We applied, and within a few short weeks, we were approved. Unbeknown to us, the owner of the property had started to talk amongst his peers and the neighbours that he would be renting his house out as a halfway house, which began to stir up a lot of the neighbours. Before long, in the street, it was decided that there would be sex offenders, violent criminals, and pedealers living on their street, and that the residents would become prisoners in their own home in fear for their own lives. Also that their property values would decrease because these people would be staying there. Earlier that month, I had run our AOG National Conference in New Plymouth and was about to take a short break to the South Island. As I was walking through security at Auckland Airport, an unknown phone number came up on my cell phone. This was the conversation. "Hello, Michelle. My name is John Smith. Now you listen very carefully about what I'm going to say. I believe you and your Roderick whatever trust plan is to come to our street. Well, I can tell you right now that you are not welcome. I am now the representative for the street, and be assured, Michelle, none of the neighbours want you or your people or your housing there. I have $100,000, Michelle, and if you choose to rent a house, be assured that I will come after you and I will sue you and your trust for the depreciation in the house value to my house because those people are on our street. And I can assure you that I'm encouraging every other house owner on the street to follow suit. I have contacted the media, and be rest assured, Michelle, they are ready to jump all over it as soon as I give them the go-ahead. You have chosen the wrong street to mess with, Michelle." My response to Mr. Smith was that the residents would be visited by our chairperson and a member of the police on our trust, which was previously arranged to happen that evening. This was met with another barrel of accusations and a final comment that Roderick Hope Trust board members were not welcome on his street. No one cares what they had to say and do not set foot on any of their properties. As you can imagine, I was in shock. My heart was racing. I started to sweat. Fear instantaneously gripped me and I thought I was going to vomit at Auckland Airport. Again, to cut a very long story short, I had the holiday from hell. I spent the entire time on the phone, sending emails, responding to the media, and crying. Then the hate mail started. Dozens of emails from residents wanting to know why we would put their lives at risk by having criminals on their street. At no time were we were we able to even tell them that these are just normal people? They're not criminals. They're mums with kids, and all they need is help. The street held a public meeting at a local primary school, which we were summoned to attend. However, being a long weekend, I was away at the bottom of the South Island. Our chairperson was away on his wedding anniversary, and Nelson, our friendly cop, was on duty. We respectfully declined the meeting, given it was sent on the eve of Labour weekend and was to be held on Labour Day Monday. The residents' meeting took place, and even though we sent an email to state we were unable to be there, the media did attend that meeting, and all manner of discussion took place. The pressure at this point had started to reach boiling point, and it hadn't even got to the worst part yet. Later that week, we were able to hold a residents' meeting at Tutamawahine, and the room was filled with hot-headed, angry, loaded residents who were ready to fire, and fire they did. I've never really felt that way in a meeting before. It was like being on trial. Every question they asked or screamed at us was met with an open, honest answer, only to be again asked with more venom. They did not want answers. They wanted the public opportunity to vent. I've never prayed or relied on God's word so much in my entire life. But we had to stand. We had to hold on to God's promises, and we had to hold on to hope. In Ephesians 6:13, it says, "Therefore put on the full armour of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and having done all else, stand." Having done all else, we had to continue to stand. Because if we couldn't stand for these families, if we couldn't handle this battle, how on earth were they ever going to be able to? Through a huge amount of prayer, a lot of talking, and some seriously godly wisdom, we made the decision to pull our plans to rent a property on that street. It was simply psychologically and emotionally unsafe for us to put a family into a house and expect them to live in an environment when the community around them detested who they were and didn't want them there. The final blow came when the owner of the property then turned on us. A man who had shown us support, or so we thought, the whole way through, then refused to let us out of the tenancy agreement. Through some further harrowing negotiations, we ended up having to involve our lawyer, which left us little option but to pay him $5,000 to see this over and done with and the trust released from the tenancy agreement. Our trust account was empty. We actually didn't have $5,000 to pay him. We only had $2,000 in our account. But through the generosity of one of our trustees, gifted the trust $3,000 to see this finally settled. I was absolutely crushed at the end of this. It really takes the scripture, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, and pray for those who despitefully use you, to a whole new level. As a team, we went through all the emotions, but who knows that we serve a God and the battle belongs to him. God carried us through an incredibly harrowing public 8 weeks where we were in the paper a total of 12 times. We made it to nationalstuff.co.nz and had over 100 hate mail emails. But God was not finished, and I certainly was not finished. Our team was not finished, and I certainly was not going to allow the enemy win. This is my city. These are our people. And come hell or high water, was I going to be beaten or crushed by this? So we went back to the drawing board, and we opened 3 more emergency houses. Over the last 18 months, we've been able to house 24 families through one of our 4 properties, which includes over 70 children. Almost every single mum has come in so low that she's cried her way through the intake process. They've lost all direction and hope. And more often than not, are completely broken. 19 out of 24 families have come with only their clothing in a suitcase, or mostly in a black sack, and no other possessions to their name. You will have read in the paper around Christmas time about the Morihu family whose house burnt down in Waitara. The family got out safely with only their pyjamas on. Everything else in the house was either fire, water or smoke damaged. Within 4 hours of this tragedy, we were able to meet with the family, complete the intake, set up our 4-bedroom property, and at 5:30pm that evening, their large family of 9 moved into the house. There was huge community drive and support for the Morihus, with everything they needed to get back on their feet, and then tragedy struck again. Their burnt house was burgled and salvageable items stolen. The family were absolutely devastated that this could happen. Then on Thursday night of the same week, the house was burgled for a second time. All through this process, Murray Daly, our property manager, was able to walk through the highs and lows, the gratitude and the frustrations of the whole situation. And that's why we do what we do. We want these families to know that they are valued, that we care about their lives and the lives of their children, and that the difficulties they have encountered do not have to dictate their future. Let me tell you about Easter weekend, a couple of weekends ago. On Thursday night, on the eve of Easter, we had a situation arise with a family of four where they'd been unlawfully evicted from their rental property with only 1 week's notice given by an extended family member after relationships broke down. They found themselves having to plead with a friend to stay in their tiny two-bedroom apartment, otherwise their only option would have been to stay in the car until work and income were able to house them after the Easter break. We were able to put them into a motel for 4 nights, and they are now in one of our properties with a wraparound social worker to support them to get assisted and back on track. On Good Friday at 10 p.m, I received a phone call from the emergency department at the hospital. A lady had presented to ED, however she wasn't sick, but she had nowhere to live and had been sleeping on the streets for the previous few nights. The hospital were desperate to find somewhere for her to stay for the weekend before she could be assisted by WINS on the Tuesday. We were able to liaise with some of our key motel partners to assist us with accommodation for her, even though it was Easter, 10 p.m, and everything in town was full. On Easter Monday, I received a call from a friend who was standing with a family on their street, watching the house they rented burn to the ground, and talking through where the family might sleep that night. A fragile and tearful daughter came onto the phone and explained that because of her elderly mother's limited mobility, there was nowhere suitable they would be able to stay. Immediately, we were able to assist this family with a disability access motel unit until work and income opened on Tuesday so a plan could be put in place and the right property identified for the family. There's something really special when a community organisation, a church, a business and a government department come together and create something that in some aspects can alter the course of a family's life in a good way, and that's where Operation Blue Santa comes in. Operation Blue Santa was first rolled out in New Plymouth in 2016. It's a collaboration between the New Plymouth Police Family Violence Team, Roderick Hope Trust and Tutama Wahine, and generously supported by a number of local community groups, businesses and churches. Family violence is a huge issue in Taranaki, with over 3,500 police call-outs in 2016. 50% of those call-outs involve children. Operation Blue Santa is the opportunity for the police to identify high-risk families who are likely to have a police family violence call-out over Christmas. Prior to Christmas, police visit with a laundry basket full of food and Christmas treats. They check in on the family, ensure a safety plan is in place should a situation arise over Christmas, while non-essential services are closed for the holidays. We know that Operation Blue Santa made a tangible difference in the lives of 210 families in Taranaki in 2017. I was speechless when we went back over the donations to see that in 4 weeks, our community had invested over $11,500 into Operation Blue Santa, as well as hundreds and hundreds of grocery items donated. We were also able to deliver over 850 Christmas presents to children in our community who would ordinarily have gone without, and over 180 mums and dads received a gift box full of toiletries. What really excites me is not only the collaboration amongst families, churches, businesses and community groups, but as a result of Operation Blue Santa, North Taranaki saw a significant drop in family violence over the Christmas break, and in South Taranaki reported a one-third drop, with 61 incidences being reported as opposed to 96 incidences for the previous year. I often have conversations with people who support us, and I love that I can't do what you do and you can't do what I do, but with our resources and our skills put together, we can actually make a tangible and lasting change in our community. In closing, I want to encourage you today that when God gives you a dream, to fight for it. You're never too old and you're never too young. Taking ground is never easy. The battle is hard and there can be blood, sweat and lots of tears involved. But we serve a God who says that you are chosen, you are a child of God, you are being changed into his image, you are a new creation, you are a temple of the Holy Spirit, you are forgiven of all your sins, you are redeemed from the curse of the law, you are blessed, you are the head and not the tail, you are above and not beneath, you are victorious, you are set free, you are strong in the Lord. You are healed by his wounds. You are free from condemnation. You are reconciled to God. You are joint heirs with Christ. You are accepted in him. You are complete in him. You are dead to sin. You are alive with Christ. You have the mind of Christ. You can do all things in Jesus Christ. You are the light of the world. You are more than a conqueror. I want to say a wholehearted and massive thank you for your kindness and generosity in supporting Operation Blue Centre. You are quite honestly making a tangible difference in the lives of dozens of families in our community. And further, I want to say a huge thank you for the load of firewood that your church and Minister Paul generously donated to a family in our community who would have struggled their way through winter keeping warm, but now have a load of dry firewood to get them through. Your generosity has assisted them more than you'll ever know. Thank you so much for having me here today, and I trust this snapshot, long snapshot, of this journey has been an encouragement to you. Thank you.